You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at magazine covers, body image, and the plus size label after a controversy involving comedian Amy Schumer and Glamour magazine. First, violence is part of the human condition, something our species has engaged in for millennia. But the science behind our violent behaviors led to some interesting theories, like how being violent might be linked to being bipedal, walking on two legs. Gemma Tarlak is here to explain these theories and other things we might not have known about violence, as well as some other interesting headlines from the science world. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, my friend. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. Now, Gemma, before we get violent, I want to talk about a couple of the other big stories. One of them you brought us is fingerprinting diseases. How do we do this?
This is a really exciting emerging field, and the fancy term for it is immune repertoire sequencing. And basically, in our body, in our immune system, we have these special cells that kind of develop little segments of DNA. We're calling them barcodes because that's the easiest way to understand them, that you get this barcode in your immune cell, and it basically says, hey, I've recognized a threat, say, influenza, and I develop this barcode that says, yes, I've encountered this threat. Scientists are learning how to sequence all the different barcodes in our individual immune systems and read them to understand what kind of threats we've been exposed to, potentially what kind of diseases we are in the earliest stages of developing. It's a really fascinating field with a lot of different aspects to it.
Yeah, so I could see that being a great early warning system, maybe at the individual level, maybe at the societal level. But could there be a problem with false positives? Hey, we fingerprinted this disease. It's never going to affect you. We don't know that we're going to treat it anyway. I could see pros and cons here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear, they are at the very, very early stages of sorting this all out. And there is the risk of false positives. Obviously, you don't want to go through very invasive, tough treatments like, say, chemotherapy, for example, if you don't really have the disease. So there's a lot of refinement going on. But one of the really interesting areas and one of the most advanced areas, there's a company out of Seattle, I believe, that has actually developed a simple blood test for certain types of cancers that can not only tell if the cancer is present, but it can also pick up a relapse months before tumors are seen in the CAT scan. So it's very early in the field, and it's definitely emerging. It's definitely refining, but it's a really exciting area.
And as I understand it, there's a prospect that this could help us figure out why vaccines work in some people, not in others. We can in effect, fingerprint the impact of vaccines.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, in older people, older folks are one of the highest risk category groups for getting, say, the annual avian influenza when it comes through our society. And there are actually ways of figuring out how to fine-tune the vaccine based on the person's, again, DNA barcode to actually make it much more effective. That's another really interesting area. But it's early on in the work. So don't expect, you know, to be seeing this at your doctor's office next year or anything. But it's under development, and it's been really promising.
Switching gears, developing countries are starting to feel impacts from climate change, especially in coastal and island areas. You brought us a story on some possible ways to cope with those impacts. So what kind of strategies are you looking here? What kind of things are we talking about to combat the impact of climate change?
Well, I love this story because it just happens that developing countries are not only expected to be the hardest hit by climate change, but they have the fewest resources and the weakest infrastructures to be able to handle it. So our writer went out and found out all these great low-tech ideas. That's the key here. It's low-tech. Most of these projects, you don't require any special training to actually put them into practice. My favorite, it's a floating school. So if you're in a flood-prone area, for not that much money and really, you know, at no, there's no downside to this, where you can build a school that floats. So as the floodwaters rise, the children don't have to worry about missing out on education, which is such a key point of breaking the poverty cycle. They can still go to school. They may have to take the boat to school, but their school floats, and it rises as the waters rise. Another great idea I really love, it's called camel hump agriculture. And basically, you have, you know, troughs in between these small raised bed areas for your crops. And in the rainy season, the troughs fill up with water. You can have fish in them that you can not only harvest the fish to eat, but the fish contribute to nutrients to the soil. And then as the drought season hits, the water levels in these troughs go down, but they're nourishing the croplands. So it's, you know, making the most out of a rainy season by actually using it, that excess water, to irrigate during the dry season.
And another consequence of rising ocean levels is salt. Salt in water, contaminating places with already scarce fresh water supplies. There's also a wind-powered, hopefully inexpensive solution for that.
Yeah. You know, right now, reverse osmosis is kind of the way that most people are desalinating water, but it's very expensive. And this is a much lower cost setup where you can actually, the wind really is driving the water through a filtration system that's actually based on copper. So it gets filtered through the copper, and it costs much less. It's much easier to set up, too. So that's actually, in certain rural areas in Colombia, it's already being used in a few test cases, and it's just doing fantastic for them.
And my favorite, I think, was permeable dams to sort of, and this is in Indonesia, I think, to mimic the effect of mangrove forests that have gone away, and then to also to help regrow those mangroves.
Yeah, and you know, if you've ever seen a photo of a mangrove forest, you can see how really the roots just extend underneath the surface of the water, and they create this like really, it's really cool looking, I think, but this really cool barrier that helps protect not only young mangrove trees, but it reduces soil erosion, it helps protect the ecosystem that's established. Unfortunately, because of things like fishing and agriculture and everything, a lot of mangrove forests have been torn up. And once they're torn up, they're really hard to regrow because the young mangroves are super sensitive to, you know, like big waves or heavy winds. So this is actually using local materials available right there. I think there's a current project in Thailand now where it looks like a fence made of sort of vertical sticks and then layers and layers of horizontal sticks. And this permeable dam actually does what an established mangrove forest would do. So it already is, it's reducing erosion, it's protecting the coastline, and you can also plant young mangroves behind it, and they're protected enough so that as they grow up, they kind of take over that function, and you're restoring a habitat that is really important to restore.
Talking about the latest science news with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. We promised violence. Gemma, you wrote 20 facts about violence. First, briefly, why did you tackle violence?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that it seems we talk a lot about violence, and there's a lot of talk about violence on TV, et cetera, but there's so many different aspects to it that I think don't get talked about. You know, it's almost cliche to just talk about violence as being the cause of this, or humans being violent, or maybe humans weren't violent until, you know, agriculture started, and maybe hunter-gatherer humans were not violent, and all these different theories, but no one really stops to look at the actual research that's gone into it. So so I did. I spent some time doing this, and I came up with a lot of really absolutely fascinating things. My favorite is probably back in 2011, there was a study noting that a lot of quadrupedal species, you know, the usual four on the floor, the dogs, the horses, etc., they rear up when they fight. And they did some research on it and looked at our evolutionary track. And they think it's possible that because when you rear up to fight, you have greater leverage. You know, your strikes actually have more power behind them than if you've got, you know, three legs on the floor and you're striking with one. So they think it's possible that our knuckle-walking ancestors, our partly quadrupedal ancestors, if the males of that species stood upright more, it made them more effective fighters, and maybe it made them better competitors for mates, and maybe they mated more, and maybe that's why you and me and humans around the world are fully bipedal. It's a crazy theory, but it's really fascinating when you think about it.
Another interesting, and this is in the theory realm of warfare, violence may be higher, maybe based in part on risk of parasite infections?
Yes, it's called the parasite stress model. And when you think about it, it makes total sense. If you've got really high rates of infectious disease in your society, that means, you know, it's harder to work if you're sick, or if, say, your breadwinner has passed away or is incapacitated, the family unit breaks down, resources get more scarce, infrastructure breaks down. You've got all these problems, and they found that in areas with high rates of infectious disease, there's more xenophobia, there's more strain of resources, and the risk of conflict is elevated. So there's the question is, can we kind of blame bugs for bugging us so much that we started up warfare? It's possible. And when you think about it, it makes sense.
And finally, why do we like violent entertainment, from the Gladiator games to violent movies? Terror management theory. Briefly, Gemma, what is that?
super briefly, basically, humans are the only species really cognizant of our own mortality. And because of that, that's a scary prospect. We need to build all these defense mechanisms to protect ourselves from just thinking about the void, so to speak. And sometimes those defense mechanisms are very elaborate, and they can be very violent. It's a really fascinating area of psychology.
And for the most part, we are spending more of our time being cooperative and peaceful than we do being violent. Good place to end it.
Look, you and I have been cooperative the past 15 minutes or so, right?
I'd like to think so. Gemma, thank you so much. It's always a lot of fun.
Always fun. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Coming up after the news, a look at body image, pop culture, and the plus size label. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.